Good afternoon, and welcome to the Kaiser Family Foundation's webcast series, U.S. Global Health Policy in Focus. We're coming to you live from our broadcast studio in Washington, D.C. I'm Jen Cates, Vice President at the Kaiser Family Foundation. In Focus brings you discussions and takes your questions about current issues and debates concerning the U.S. government's role in global health. Each live webcast features leaders in their fields sharing their views and experiences. Today, we are very pleased to have an expert panel to discuss the health and development-related outcomes of the G20 summit, which took place in Cannes, France, last week. During the summit, leaders of the world's largest economies discussed a range of issues, including reforming international financial institutions, achieving sustainable economic development, and other topics, but of course were primarily concerned with addressing the immediate Eurozone crisis. So where were global health and development in this mix? Prior to the summit, many had hoped they would get new attention. Did they? What was the impact of a much-anticipated and unprecedented report from Bill Gates to G20 leaders on financing for development? Here to talk about these issues are three experts. We have Catherine Bliss, Senior Fellow and Deputy Director of the CSIS Global Health Policy Center, Deb Derrick, Senior Program Officer for Global Health Policy and Advocacy at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, and Josh Michaud, Principal Policy Analyst in Global Health Policy here at the Kaiser Family Foundation. Welcome to all of you, and thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
And to our audience, today's conversation is a live webcast, and we encourage you to submit questions to us along the way by emailing infocus@kff.org. I'll be monitoring questions as we go. So I'm going to start. I'd like to ask a general question, but I'll start with you, Catherine, to just give us some context about the G20. You know, why is the G20 an important body of donors to consider for health and development? What is it about?
The G20 is a group of 19 countries plus the European Union. It was established in 1999 in response to the late 90s financial crises. And its original goal was to bring finance ministers and central bank governors together to talk about emerging market economies and incorporating them into a discussion to reduce susceptibility to global crises. In 2008, in the context of the global financial crisis, we saw the G20 elevated to a summit-level discussion, and now it really frames itself as the principal forum for discussion on international cooperation around economic issues, our international economic development issues, with a focus on the international financial architecture, dialogue on national policy, and the role of the international financial institutions. It's important because it's significantly more representative than some of the other groups that we've seen, like the G7, the G8. It represents 90% of global gross national product, 80% of global trade, and two-thirds of the world's population. So this is really represents a very significant group. It's governed by a rotating chair, so it also increases the possibility that each country or member that, as it takes over the chair, has the chance to set an agenda. And we've also seen the Troika as part of the governing body, but really kind of representing continuity between the previous year, the current year, and the next year. So, I think in many ways it's more representational than some of the other groups that we've seen, and includes the emerging and less developed countries than just the industrial ones.
So. Okay, great. Thanks. So given that, in leading up to Cannes and sort of the discussion that was going on prior, what was expected from this summit on health and development? There was a Seoul summit consensus on development and a commitment to a multi-year action plan on development. So what was the hope going into this that the G20 would do? Maybe optimistically, what was the hope?
Well, I might turn it on its head and say that one of the fears was that given that there was this major financial issue going on in Europe, that development and health were not going to make it onto the agenda at all, or not very significantly. So I think that was one of the concerns.
Mm-hmm. And I'd also add, as Catherine said, the origins of the G20 were related to the financial ministers getting together from the countries, and then it was in 2008 that the heads of state started getting together for the summit level. And compared to the G8 and some of these other international bodies, the development agenda hadn't been as prominently placed, but you mentioned the Seoul summit, and it was really there, I think, that a more concrete plan was put forth about development that the G20 could address, and that was brought forth by the Korean hosts that year. So going into Cannes, part of the question was, would the G20 at this summit be able to further that plan, and what progress had been made up to that point?
And I know many groups were hoping that, and what were some of the issues that they were pushing for to be on the agenda? at the summit?
Well, the Seoul plan had a number of different elements to it. So it talked about 9 pillars. I wouldn't want to go over all of those 9 pillars, but important components of that, which are related to global health, have to do with at least going to the Cannes summit, looking at financing, the traditional overseas development assistance that countries provide, meeting the commitments and supporting international goals that are already out there, like the Millennium Development Goals, but also in this case looking at the possibility of bringing other sources of financing, mm-hmm. so-called innovative financing mechanisms, and that was on the agenda this time. And it hadn't been highlighted specifically in past summits very much, but it definitely was brought on by the French government, who was a strong, the Sarkozy was a strong proponent of bringing in that discussion this time.
That's actually a great segue, because one of the things that we know happened at the summit and was fairly unprecedented was Bill Gates being asked to prepare a report and present it. And Deb, will you tell us about that? You know, how did this come about? Why was this significant? And what did the report contain in terms of its goals?
Well, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is one of its primary missions is to make things more equitable for people around the world and make sure that anyone, no matter where they're born, gets access to tools and services that allow them to lead a healthy, productive life. So Bill Gates, in his work with the foundation, goes and travels around and meets with people all around the world and proselytizes on behalf mm-hmm. of this. And so he was having a meeting with President Sarkozy in France, and they were having a discussion about official development assistance and the crisis, not crisis, but the difficulties of meeting the commitments that had been mm-hmm. put forward by the developed world and meeting things like the Gavi Pledge or the Global Fund Pledge. And so he was, they were talking about what to do about that and also recognizing the fact that there's a tectonic shift going on in mm-hmm. terms of the global economy. And so whereas the developing world has seen flat or not so great growth altogether, there are many other countries around the world which have seen tremendous growth and have had great success in reducing poverty rates and implementing programs that help their own populations in terms of health or agriculture or development goals. So altogether, taking a look at those changes, there was a discussion between the two of them about how to sort of bring those changes to the forefront and how to explore the possibility of coming up with innovative or new financing mechanisms so that the world stays on track to meet some of the goals of the MDG goals and to just further the tremendous progress that's been made in global health and development around the world to date. So when Bill put his report together, for example, one of the first things that he led off with was some tremendous statistics that people just generally overlook. It's easy to focus on negative news, but there's been great progress in global health and development. And for example, 1 billion people's lives have been saved from starvation because of advances in agriculture and agricultural productivity. And that's been over the last 50 years. Over the same last 50 years, you've gone from 20 million children under the age of 5 dying from preventable causes down to 8 million. Also, again, over a 50-year period. And that with population growth altogether, that means there's been an 80% reduction in preventable child deaths. And so you start off letting people know, and Bill wants people to know, that there has been great progress and that development aid, health and development aid, has contributed significantly to that, and it would be a great shame to walk back or to not continue that progress at this point in time. So that was first one of the things that he wanted to highlight. And then within that, the question is, okay, so how do you make sure that aid is effectively delivered and used? And he, of course, comes at his whole life favoring innovation and feeling like you can jump straight over major hurdles mm-hmm. by adopting innovative techniques and innovative drugs or seeds or other technological, but also sort of sociological things. And so if you're looking at development and you're exploring what can you do to promote development, if you are just relying on the traditional aid donors, then that's a very narrow band of people to work with. When, as I said, the economy in the globe is shifting and you have a lot more resources in a lot of different areas, not just official government development assistance. So in his report, he talked about some of these other potential sources of development assistance, not least of which is the fact that countries like Brazil and China and Mexico have been leading the way in terms of their own development and poverty reduction and have an awful lot to share with the rest of the world. So one of the things that the report recommended was developing and furthering triangular partnerships between donor countries and these rapidly growing economies so that they can share their expertise with countries that haven't moved so far so fast economically. Secondly, the developing countries also have their own set of resources which could be tapped into, and he put forward some ideas on how to do that. Didn't write off the idea of official development assistance because that's still a major source of funding for this, and so pressed again for developing or the developed world to make sure that it meets the commitments that it has made in the past, and reiterated the fact that it's, you know, generally 1% or less, around 1% that the developing world is putting forward into development assistance and health assistance. And, you know, most Americans, for example, think that we're putting something like 20% of our budget into foreign assistance when it's more like 1%. So it's a really high-value investment for a small dollar amount. And then he talked about the private sector, about which he knows a lot, both promoting philanthropy and other philanthropists to invest in this area, sovereign wealth funds, and whether or not they might be able to commit to infrastructure, which can also help with development and growth, diaspora communities, remittances, and different mechanisms to tap into market forces to pull more assistance and money into development causes. And finally, he talked about some potential revenue sources or taxes, something which may not be
we don't talk about too much in the U.S.
No,
right
not
now.
In the United States, no. So I think that that's a summary of where where we were.
And we'll come back to many of those issues in a moment. And Josh, I know you want to say something. I think the point about ODA and traditional ODA is really a critical one. We just are today releasing our annual analysis of ODA for health from the DAC donors, the major donors, and certainly they provide a lion's share of direct financial assistance for global health, but that's been, you know, over the last decade, that really was on the rise, and now we see it kind of not rising as fast, and also not tapping into potentially some of these other sources. So I think it becomes a really important part of the conversation.
Yeah, I was just going to add, you know, I think it's important to put context around the fact that Bill Gates was at the G20 and that you had mentioned it was unprecedented in the fact that no one who is not a member of one of the governments or one of the multilateral institutions had presented in this formal way at a G20 summit. So it was unprecedented in that way. And it had to do with, I think, the priorities, again, of the French hosts and Sarkozy and the former French foreign minister have been years-long advocates of innovative financing or thinking of innovative ways to do development financing. It was a former French foreign minister who created or was part of the creation of Unitaid, for example, which now uses an innovative financing mechanism of airline ticket taxes to direct funds for drugs for HIV, TB, and malaria, for example. So it was an important step and I think a signal for the importance for the French hosts for this particular
topic.
Yes,
and President Sarkozy was also very interested or keen on promoting the MDGs, the Millennium Development Goals, too, and was trying to help further those goals as things that the world ought to buy into and invest in.
We actually we have a question that's specific to this. So I think I'll bring it up now. Somebody had written this in and generally about goals. Jeff Muir from the Public Health Institute asked a question about global goals and donors that agree to global goals like MDGs, like the International Conference on Population Development, the Cairo Conference. So in terms of the role that the G20 as a body of donors or even individuals have in adopting those and promoting those, and partially goes to the earlier point you made about who the host is and what how important it is, but I don't know if any of you have thoughts about the G20 and those kind of global health goals and the MDGs. And
Well, I think it's terrific to get as much buy-in as possible because what you're doing essentially is changing social norms, right? Mm-hmm. So you're saying it's not acceptable for women to die in childbirth. It's not acceptable for babies to die of preventable causes. And so if you have goals that are concrete that everybody can agree on, and that's the idea of the MDGs is we have agreed on them as a globe, then it's normalizing those goals. And the more countries you get to buy in, the better off you are.
Okay, so now I think we're going to actually go to what happened at the summit and sort of the readout at the summit. And generally a question that probably has no right answer, but was it a win for health and development or was it overtaken by the Eurozone crisis in Greece? Some say it was an important step forward. Others say development got completely overshadowed. I'm curious what your views are. We actually have a question about this. That was sent by Lori Garrett from the Council on Foreign Relations, and she asks, given the Eurozone crisis, how optimistic are you that commitments for global health and anti-poverty efforts will be made and, more importantly, fulfilled? And she writes, today the IMF announced the entire world economy is heading into, quote, a lost decade, end quote, of economic stagnation, declining consumer demand, high unemployment, and potential instability. Is it realistic to think in this climate that the G20 will give much more than lip service to any issues other than economics, finance, and global stability and security? Which I think is partially the main topic that we're trying to grapple with today. But so I'll open it up and see who wants to jump in on that one.
I can jump in first. I mean, I'd say that while the goals often going into these summits are broad and long-term in their outlook, what often happens, it seems, is that the short-term concerns of the day do tend to take over, and that certainly was the case here, as you mentioned, the Eurozone debt crisis. It ended up swallowing up a whole lot of people's time and attention, and there's really no way there was no way for the leaders to get around not focusing on that. But that said, I think whether or not this was a win or not is a little bit in the eye of the beholder and who you talk to, because some people say just the fact that a session was dedicated to financing for development was an important step, that the leaders again supported the goals that were laid out in the multi-year action plan for development at the Seoul summit are seen as positive signs, but it's hard to ignore the darker clouds that are out there. And I think the donor funding report, which you referenced, we just released, which shows that global health funding through the end of 2009 had increased, but it seemed to be at a slowing rate. And so we'll see where that goes, but it certainly doesn't bode that well, and it's something to be concerned about, I think.
But I'd say I took a look at the report, and because I'm a data type of person, I actually counted the number of not lines but pages dedicated to each topic.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think it was a 13-page report, and of that, it was about 50-50 between the financial crisis and what we're going to do about, or what the world is wants to do about the financial crisis, and development, financing for development, and agriculture, productivity, and so on. I mean, so that's pretty substantial that you got that much language put into this communique that came out of the G20. So when by all rights, with the European crisis going on, you might not have had anything. Mm-hmm. So I think it's pretty significant that you got that much language in to begin with. And it was, I believe, the first ever endorsement by the G20 of aid obligations. And so once again, you're normalizing the idea that these issues need to be addressed, and yes, we will address that. I mean, and so that gives you a platform from which you can move forward.
I think it's true that the Greek situation and the European crisis dominated a lot of the reporting and a lot of the discussion. But if you look at the communique, the declaration, and, you know, what came out of the development working group, I mean, you do see discussion about agriculture and food price volatility, a fairly significant discussion about nutrition and making significant progress on nutrition, food, emergency stores for national kind of reserves for food crises. On climate change, there was, some support for innovative financing for climate change and support for some of the discussion that will happen at the Durban COP later this year, and also this, around a green climate fund to help countries adapt to, the potentially negative effects of climate change, this importance of the continuity of overseas development assistance, and then also a focus on jobs, youth, and social inclusion, this idea of the social protection floors that Michelle Bachelet is going to be leading an advisory group about some of that. So, and as well an issue or a discussion around transparency, which, of course, is connected to the financial issues, but also, of course, is critically important for all of the development things that we've been talking about.
It's almost a little bit of an artificial separation to say the crises that were dealt with don't have anything to do with, they're one and the same. Mm-hmm. And actually, thanks for raising the social protection floors, because we did get a question about that. With where development was discussed, much of the attention was on innovative financing. But the social development floors that were put into the communique as something that the G20 agreed to foster, it was an important step. And we did get that question from Robert Lovelace from the Trade Union Sustainable Development Unit. So you want to take a moment to explain what those are? and just we'll just note that they too were part of the mix.
I mean, as I understand it, there was a significant push for, an adoption of language around these floors, or basically the minimum services that the country should provide around healthcare access, social security benefits for the elderly, recognition of child benefits, benefits for the unemployed, and these kinds of things. And they've asked Michelle Bachelet, the former president of Chile, to chair an advisory group to come up with some recommendations that will be taken up at the next Mexico meeting. So. Yeah. It's significant that the countries have agreed to look into this and make recommendations. It'll be interesting to see what comes.
We can talk after Mexico about that.
Yes, next year.
Next year. Okay. So the Gates report, Bill Gates delivered his report. How obviously it was reflected. Many of the things were reflected in the communique. But how was it received just in the general during the summit and since then, what has been the traction around it and the potential follow-up?
I think it was just generally well received, and again, the idea is that we have set forward, or the G20 has now set forward some more general aspirations, but gives us a platform for moving forward. So from the foundation's point of view, we mentioned in the report that we've been working with countries like China or Brazil and coming on Korea with the effectiveness of aid meeting that's coming up soon. So we're going to continue the conversations with individual countries and on a bilateral basis. But beyond that, have been invited to come back or to continue working on deliverables from both France and Mexico. So I expect that this will be a continued engagement of the Gates Foundation and of the people that is bringing civil society a little further into the mix of G20 activities.
Wow. So let's go to one of the specific types of recommendations or areas or mentioned in the report that was also, as we talked about, a subject of on the development side was innovative financing. And what does that mean? What promise does it bring? And I'd say it's probably one of the more complicated topics in global health and development. I'd love to hear more about your views on where it can go from here, but also help our audience even understand what it is. And I'm going to put Josh on the spot because he was the main author of something looking at these mechanisms, and then others can kind of join in.
Yeah, well, we looked at it, as you know, in the context of global health. So innovative financing is not, I would say, a new idea. People have been talking about it for quite a while. And the World Bank and some other institutions have come up with definitions for it. But basically, I think it's important to frame it as you have your traditional overseas development assistance, the ODA, which comes through bilateral support and multilateral means as well. And then innovative financing would be either sources of funds that are in addition to those and complementary to those, or you could also think about it as with the funds that you have, whatever source they might have come from, can you spend it better? Can you be smarter about that money? So that there are also mechanisms which aim to get more impact out of each dollar that you do have. So when we took a look at this for the field of global health, what we saw were three main categories of innovative financing mechanisms, and one being a sort of novel financing sources, and that would include things like the financial transaction tax,
which I'm going to have you talk about in a minute,
and some other taxes, but also sort of more private-based things like a voluntary tax on airline tickets and many other things, and the product red and those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. A second category would be mechanisms which aim to stimulate research and development and innovation, specifically related to products, but not entirely. So think of drugs and vaccines. What are the mechanisms that are either proposed or actually functioning right now, which aim to speed up the process of getting from an idea to a drug or a vaccine or a diagnostic? You know, it's a very important part of what global health tries to do. So there are mechanisms out there like the Advanced Market Commitment, which tries to get products out and used in the field quicker than they may have without that mechanism being there. And there are some other things such as prizes and other mechanisms, mm-hmm. which aim to try and speed up that process of innovation. And then the third and final category would be mechanisms which try to incentivize performance or results. That's where you're squeezing more dollars mm-hmm. out of the, and squeezing more impact out of the dollars that you do have. And so these ideas about, you know, results-based aid and cash on delivery aid, mm-hmm. Which are a few sort of jargony terms, but these are examples of trying to tie the impact that you get to the dollars that are spent.
Okay, so financial transaction tax.
Yeah. Well, you know, the financial transaction tax is an idea that's been around a long time, originally proposed. The name Tobin was attached to the Tobin tax. An American economist back in the 70s talked about this. And really, it's just the idea of having a micro tax on transactions, financial transactions. Those could be many different things. Mm-hmm. So you could be talking about currency exchanges. You could be talking about you know, derivatives. Or there's a whole bunch of different classes that you could assign that tax to. And then taking the revenues from that tax and applying it to, in this case, global health or development efforts. It's interesting to note that while there is no global tax like this, it has been implemented in a number of countries, and probably most prominently the UK has its own version known as the stamp duty, where they have mm-hmm. a financial transaction tax, which is used for domestic purposes. But it's been shown to be operational, and this was a very strong interest of President Sarkozy. And France, along with some other European nations, have been strong supporters of implementing a global, or if not a global, then a EU-wide,
more widely used.
A widely used financial transaction tax. And, you know, there are some estimates out there of significant potential revenues from doing that, although not everyone is a strong supporter of it.
Okay, we'll get to that in a moment. So how did it fare at the G20, this idea of the financial transaction tax? You know, it was pushed. It was definitely something the French host wanted to see. It was mentioned in the report. How did it? What's your sense of how it fared as a potential mechanism?
Well, I don't know if you want to go. Going into it, you kind of knew who was the supporters of it. So France and Germany and some other, and in fact, the European Commission came out for it as well. Although, one question around the support is what will the funds be directed for in the end? And so people support the tax in theory. Sometimes there's some discussion about whether that should be used and what percentage should be used for different purposes. That's a discussion which is still out there to be had. But there, the United Kingdom and the United States have been not directly supportive of it, although in the communique, in the final document, it is mentioned as something to think about for the G20 countries. So I don't know if you wanted to add anything else.
No, I was just going to say it was, you know, interesting that, some countries, you know, influential countries did join, you know, in that discussion as well. You saw Brazil and South Africa and Argentina and Ethiopia, you know, also joining in support of the financial transaction tax. You know, Brazil and South Africa have already, you know, also implemented some kind of version, you know, of this at home. And, you know, I think we're encouraged by the discussion around making sure that some of those revenues were, absolutely included, either for the kind of social protection issues that, we discussed or the broader, you know, health and development agenda. So, you know, that, you know, there was a lot of reporting around the fact that, you know, because, you know, influential countries, you know, within the group of emerging markets, you know, like Brazil and South Africa, had joined in support of this, that was that was likely to lead to a greater discussion as well.
And I'd just like to mention that, of course, there's no governing world body that's going to force a tax on anybody, right? So it's up to individual countries to make a determination, which is important in the American context because, as you all know, right now, you know, the U.S. Congress is showing little to no appetite for any taxes of any kind or increased taxes of any kind. So I think that that's, you know, a significant factor in how far and fast this is likely to go.
Great. And actually, I want to turn in a moment to the U.S. context to sort of have that discussion. And just before we do, in terms of the financial transaction tax, so I guess it's a similar kind of thing. Was it a win for global health or not? It kind of depends how it being put on the agenda, that some see that as a win for having it there and going forward. We actually did get a question. The students at a Case Western undergraduate class on international health were very active in following this and sent a number of questions, and one of them was about financing mechanisms. And which or what does any of you have an opinion on or a perspective on what are the most effective new financing mechanisms that were proposed at the G20 summit, and what was the cause or issue that you would see it being best applied to? And we've talked about a number of them. I don't know if you have thoughts on going forward, what might be really, whether it's gaining traction on something or it's really the thing that has a bigger bang for a buck.
Well, in Bill Gates' report, one of the things he notes is that the developing countries themselves, their own resources, the largest potential source of financing in the future, right? So if your population is demanding or wants healthcare or wants agricultural development and so on, then it's hard, it becomes hard for its leaders to turn around and just walk away from that. So I think that, you know, developing the revenues and the sources and the transparency to allow that is probably in the long run the largest potential source of financing.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, it depends what you define as being effective and whether it's raising the most money or having the greatest likelihood of actually being enacted, those two things might not be completely on the same page. So, you know, the fact that there was this attention on the financial transaction tax, and it was brought up in the Gates report, but even independent of that, there was a movement around it even prior to the summit. You know, it seems like there is some life beyond Cannes for that particular. Now, where that goes and whether that will be directed towards the development objectives that the global health community would like or the development community would like, it's hard to say. Mm-hmm. But you know, there is some life in that. And at least reading some of the commentary afterwards, it seems like at least a EU wide or at least some zone of the EU having a financial transaction tax going forward, it might be a definite possibility.
So a couple of you have mentioned already the U.S. government and its role, well, in many ways, but specifically thinking about the U.S. government and its engagement in health and development at this summit. Obviously, most of what we see in the press is not about that with regard to the U.S. It really was about the Eurozone crisis. I did see in President Obama's press briefing readout to the press about the summit, he did mention that the communique, of course, does talk about the importance of addressing poverty and development, but that's a very small piece. So what's your sense about how the U.S. did or did not position itself in regard to the potential of a development and global health agenda? Did it play in this field? I know this relates to innovative financing, And actually, I want to read a question we got that I think to get to the innovative financing aspect of it, and maybe, Josh, you want to answer this too, from Porter McConnell at Oxfam. She writes, do you think it's significant that the U.S. backed away from its formerly vocal objections to a European financial transaction tax at Cannes? Do you expect any movement on the issue at next year's G20? So that's one view on that. But in general, does any of you want to comment on how you saw the U.S. playing in this mix at all on the development and global health agenda?
Well, I'd say that, While the dominant theme would have been one of just economic stability and structure in Europe altogether, that there's just no denying that the U.S. government is and in all likelihood will continue to be a driver of investments in global health, especially in global health and development. And so it's to take this one event and this one meeting and to suggest that it's we're backing away from things or the U.S. isn't involved is, I think, not accurate, because we have a long history of being supportive of this. And one of the reasons that we do is because there's significant traction in Congress. I mean, people can understand that if you invest in a bed net, you reduce the number of cases of malaria. If you invest in ARVs, you're going to prevent someone from dying of HIV/AIDS. It's a very concrete kind of assistance, which is, you know, notably more trackable than other kinds of assistance in the past. So I don't see any reason to believe that the U.S. is going to back off in a substantial way from its official development assistance in health and development. And so while it may or may not rise to a high level in each individual communique out of each one of these G8 or G20 meetings, I fully expect that we'll be the government will be quite in the mix.
Mm-hmm. And actually, yesterday, Secretary Clinton made a very important speech on global AIDS commitments by the U.S., pointing out, I think, in general, some of these same themes about ODA from donors, the U.S. included, but others, and ways to innovate.
Right.
Based on the new science. So that is in keeping with what you're saying.
You know, as far as the innovative financing angle goes, while not directly addressed by the G20, I mean, it's important to note that while the U.S. hasn't expressed support for the financial transaction tax, there are a number of other innovative financing mechanisms that the U.S. does participate in. And so when we looked at all the different mechanisms.
And how many did we track? We looked at
There was 31, like 31 across those three mechanisms that are three categories that I had mentioned, the U.S. was either supportive or directly involved in over half of those. Mm-hmm. So, but we did notice that the U.S. was less likely to support purely public-based mechanisms where you're talking about taxes. Mm-hmm. Tax-based revenue sources, and much more likely to support the mixed sort of public but
private,
mixed with private
mechanisms.
So things like the priority review voucher, which is a method of trying to stimulate research and development by providing pharmaceutical companies with a special voucher which gives them accelerated review for a product, that turns into a monetary value for a company, and so that becomes valuable for them. That's a U.S. idea, and in fact, the U.S. country the only one that has implemented that right now. So, it's definitely a trend towards one type of mechanism versus other types, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. What about the sort of larger congressional context here, and you'd started in general the bipartisan support for global health historically, but given where we are right now, I don't know if you want to share your what you think about the context, and it's not just around financial transaction taxes or taxes, but just generally where we are as a government in terms of thinking about these issues in foreign aid and development.
Well, again, you have to take it in the U.S. context, you have to put it in the broader budgetary context, which is, of course, very difficult. And there is a broad consensus that we have to cut back on spending altogether and otherwise get the deficits and debts addressed. So I think everything across the board is on the table, and evidently Congress is having a hard time getting to its decision-making with that everything on the board. But Bill Gates has said, and I can't reiterate enough, you're not gonna solve the deficit issue on the back of 1% of your federal budget, right? You're just simply not going to get to trillions of dollars in debt reduction or deficit reduction. So this is it's a minor slice of what the U.S. government is spending, and for that minor slice, it provides this incredible tool, a foreign policy tool, that gives you something other than guns and boats and bombs to go and address what's happening in the world. And so I think it's a tremendous asset. And it's easy to stand up and grandstand against foreign assistance and giving money to foreigners, but it's a small slice. And we, better or worse, the U.S. government is engaged in the world, has to be engaged in the world. And so this is a high value, small cost investment that, again, you can't solve the deficit issues on this.
Mm-hmm. And we'll certainly know more in the next maybe few days, or next week. Anyone else on the U.S. Context and thinking about?
Well, no, I think that said it all. It's hard. It is hard to prioritize in this context. But having some perspective on the percentage that we're talking about of the budget is important, as you said.
So speaking of another set of actors, and we'll come back to the U.S. again, but speaking of another set of actors, and Catherine, you already brought up Brazil and South Africa in particular, but this brings up another donor group, the BRICS, and why is it so significant what Brazil and South Africa are choosing to focus on and do right now, and what is, tell us about the BRICS and why we might all want to pay attention to that group, what they did at the G20, and just beyond the G20?
Well, the BRICS are kind of an unusual group. An analyst at Goldman Sachs came up with, the term BRIC to describe Brazil, Russia, India, and China.
It's a good acronym.
Fast-growing economies that were poised to take over the G7, in the next few years. And, the BRIC countries themselves decided that it could be strategic for them to, work together, to communicate together. They recognized that they already had a lot of trade, going on among themselves. And, so they began meeting in the run-up to some of these major international discussions. They brought South Africa. South Africa, often you did hear BRICS. South Africa was kind of formally invited to be part of the BRICS over this past year. They make an effort to coordinate their positions in advance of major meetings, and they've also had several ministerials or declarations. We know that the BRICS presidents or heads of state did meet in Cannes prior to the G20, supposedly to coordinate positions largely around whether they would offer money to bail out some of the European countries. They've also lobbied for greater voting rights for those countries within the IMF and other sets of issues, but it's kind of tough to know how influential the BRICS as a unit are going to be in a lot of these discussions. I mean, they do have a number of elements of a common agenda. They're interested in UN reform. They want to see greater voice for developing countries within a lot of the international discussions. But they have significant differences and competition among them as well. And so I think it's not always possible to assume that the BRICS, they meet and discuss, but they're not always going to have unified ideas on a lot of these things. But I think they are very much united on the ideas around social protection, around improving development and health conditions in a lot of the countries that they kind of see themselves as representing, those other countries in the G20 that have been brought into those discussions. And so, I think when we talk about BRICS, we can also talk about, this expanded group, kind of friends of BRICS, if you want, Mexico, Turkey, Indonesia, some of the other members of the G20 that they're also becoming donors, they're also becoming active in this kind of horizontal and south-south cooperation and really trying to share their own experiences and, really energizing their own economies to share those with others. And so, it's interesting to see them coordinating in advance of a lot of these discussions. How much ultimately that influences as a block remains to be seen, but I think individually they also exert a fair amount of influence.
And certainly, Deb, subject to the trilateral arrangements that were in the report about and countries, emerging economies really taking on a different role.
Yes, one of the people that I cite all the time, anyone who hasn't watched Hans Rosling, yes, and his, yes, tremendous presentation on demographics and economic growth. It's just astounding illumination of what the changes are going on in the world, and this is all part of the adjustment to those changes, I think.
And from the perspective of someone who, at Kaiser, we try to track what donors are doing, it's presented a bit of a quandary, because for all those countries, they're at this pivotal point, and many of them have, as you mentioned, Catherine, become donors themselves. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, they're still in that transition phase of being recipients of aid.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And because that is a complex picture, it's really hard to know, is it a wash at this point? Is it a gain? It's certainly potentially a gain in terms of a new vision of role in responding to global health issues. But it's an open question, I think. But we seem to be at that pivotal point where it really will shift in the next few years, and hopefully will enable those of us who like to track those things a better ability to track them.
And they're also supportive of the innovative sort of financing mechanism as well, because you know Brazil, being one of the founding countries around Unitaid, mm-hmm, and the airline, mm-hmm, tax, and. Mm-hmm. Has expressed support at least for the financial transaction tax.
Used for development.
If it's used for development. Mm-hmm. Same goes for South Africa. And I don't know about the other BRICS countries, but certainly those two have been supportive, mm-hmm, of these mechanisms.
Mm-hmm. So I think we, you know, turning to where we go from here a little bit, looking ahead, the stage is starting to maybe be set. There's a general question about where the global health and development agenda for the G20 goes. You mentioned, Josh, that it's, and historically this is how it kind of formed, it's the short-term financial crises that it tend to take the front and center, and probably should at some level, but these longer-term challenges need to be addressed. So what is the outlook for Mexico and some of the lead-up to that? That's one question I'm going to put out there. Another one I'm curious about is we didn't talk about the G8 today, and in fact, the G8 in the past has been a real subject of the Global Health and Development Agenda, but not so much this past year. Next year, the U.S. is hosting the G8. What will that do to this discussion, potentially elevating or not this attention to global health? And it will also be in the midst, the U.S., will be in the midst of a presidential campaign, which can cut in a very different way. So I'm going to stop there and just throw those couple things out and see, you know, any perspectives you have on the future, what could happen, what might happen, what are the open questions to think about, pay attention to.
Well, I would say that in the for global health as opposed to development,
yep,
or agriculture,
yep,
more generally, there was not as much language in the G20 report this time as there had been in prior G8 reports. So I think one of the things that will be promoted and probably deserve some greater attention is seeing if we can pull more, mm-hmm, global health issues into the next G20, mm-hmm, report. So that's one thing I would say.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, you saw in a lot of the press, a lot of NGOs were very disappointed in you know, the seemingly lack of, you know, real commitments or discussion around health and development in Cannes. So, you know, it does seem that a lot of people are really looking to Mexico.
A little pressure on Mexico.
A little pressure to put international development, you know, right there in the middle of the next summit agenda. I think, you know, Mexico has been a leader on a lot of climate change issues. They hosted the Cancun Conference, mm-hmm, of Parties last year. Calderon, the president, had proposed a green climate fund in the past. So I think, you know, it's possible we'll see climate change on there. Mm-hmm. Jobs and social inclusion have been, you know, very important, you know, issue in the region in Latin America. So, you know, again, that may be something that we'll see. Health, you know, is a little unclear, but I think, you know, it's important to remember that Mexico in 2012 will also be in a presidential election cycle. By the time the summit happens, that will have already been decided. But, you know, it's hard to know how much any of that will influence the agenda as they, you know, kind of develop that. Mexico takes over December 1st, I think.
Right.
And so they'll have, you know, at least 6 or 7 months before the elections to really be putting that in place.
Right.
So, I mean, it's hard to know how much that will influence. But it's something to think about as well.
And the G8? Being U.S. host, and actually interesting that Mexico and the U.S. and Northern, will have both
North America.
North America hosting these two important moments. And I'll throw out another one that's happening, with the U.S. being the host for AIDS 2012, bringing back the largest conference, international conference on a global health topic that exists for the first time in more than 20 years. And one way to look at it is this is a happy convergence where we can see some more momentum at the other, but all these other intervening factors, the financial crisis writ large, and then the election seasons, et cetera.
Well, on that point, I'd note that the opening of this G20 report talked about jobs and the economy.
And sounds familiar.
If I were to predict, a U.S.-based G8 report will also have an awful lot of emphasis on jobs and economic development, domestic or global economic development. Mm-hmm. So I would think that would be up there on the top. And
I mean, as you mentioned, it's right in the midst of the heat of the presidential campaign, so a lot of it will depend on the temperature of the public opinion around that time and events that will occur between now and then, which will be impossible to predict, I imagine. So it's potentially going to be important, and as you said, the G8 has been an important place for global health discussions in the past. So we can keep our fingers crossed and see what happens in the future. But a lot will depend on circumstances.
Mm-hmm. So I think we're nearing the end here. But just for our audience to think about what would be some important moments, meetings, things that are leading up to those points to watch for, things that may take place in the next 6 months to that point that can give us the pulse on all of this. Any other thoughts you want to share in reflecting back on, are we going into the lost decade, or are we really going to see health and development, or health particularly?
Well, my focus is, because I do U.S. government relations for the foundation here on global health, and so my focus is a little bit narrower. It tends to focus on the U.S., but what I'd say that I see coming up is, first of all, in the U.S. context, the super committee and the decisions that they're making are going to be critical, because that'll determine how much or how little accounts like foreign assistance are likely to be reduced, and that'll lay some groundwork for many years to come. But then also there's Global AIDS Day that's coming up, and as you mentioned earlier, the International AIDS Conference in the middle of the summer in the run-up to the election. So I think those are a couple of really key things to watch.
Mm-hmm. But I think, coming up, you on climate, we have the Durban Conference of Parties coming up toward the, later this month, toward the end of the year, the Busan meeting on aid effectiveness.
Right.
Also, the World Water Forum in March tends to be, a place where a lot of development issues are also discussed. So, I think just kind of on the international conference agenda or whatever, there are opportunities, whether they're ministerials or just more informal gatherings, where some of these issues will be brought up. And also, this year in July, the BRICS health ministers met for the first time and issued a declaration saying that they were willing to cooperate on universal health access and other issues. Now, there hasn't been a lot of progress since then, but at least they've met, and so it may be an opportunity for them to, come together again and really try to push this agenda for Mexico, and elsewhere.
And, of course, the U.N. General Assembly as well is one of those standard markers.
Yes. Okay, so a lot that we can pay attention to and see what happens on the health side, and maybe come back here, all of us, next summer, after next summer, to see where it ended up. I think we'll close now. Our time's up. I'd first like to thank our panelists, Catherine Bliss, Deb Derrick, and Josh Michaud, for being here and sharing your views and perspectives with us. And to our audience, I would like to thank all of you for your questions. On our website, globalhealth.kff.org, you will find additional resources on today's In Focus, and we encourage you to share the video and transcript with your own audiences. We also hope that you will join us for future webcasts of U.S. Global Health Policy In Focus. I'm Jen Cates of the Kaiser Family Foundation. Thank you.